I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Back in 1915, President Woodrow Wilson screened The Birth of a Nation, a film that celebrated white supremacy and the KKK at the White House for a small audience. Earlier this year, President Biden screened the film Till at the White House about the gruesome murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till in Mississippi in the 1950s and the campaign by his mother, Mamie Till, for justice for her son. Biden told the invited guests, "We should know everything about our history. That's what great nations do." There is a battle today, as you know, in many of our schools about how and what and whether to teach the truth about the complicated American story. This includes banning books deemed controversial, watering down curricula about black history, and whitewashing the ugly parts of our past and present. Well, today on The Connection, what history and psychology can teach us about the importance of being honest about who we are as a nation and who we are as individuals, understanding the resistance and embracing the difficult truths. Let me introduce our guests. Dolly Chugg is social psychologist, professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU, author of a book that just came out, A More Just Future. Dolly, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State University, Editor of Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. And Hassan, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Great to be with you.
In fact, let me begin with you, Hassan. This is not a new argument or debate that's happening, whether in schools or in Congress or in legislatures or probably in people's living rooms as well, this argument about who we are as a country. But do you think there's something unique going on today?
You're right. This isn't anything new. Our education and our history in particular has always been politicized. It's always been debated. So I think this is the continuation of something that we've seen as long as we have had public education. But context matters, and the particular moment in which we live matters. And the way in which education is being politicized in this moment matters. I think it very much has everything to do with an activist generation of young people. In the summer of 2020, we saw the largest protest in American history. And they were demanding for an honest telling of the past, including an end to systemic racism. And I think the politicization of history coming from the political right in the moment is a direct response to that manifestation of activism among young people. So it's an extension of the past, but it is absolutely responding to incidents in the present.
And Dolly, just picking up on that, you write in your book about tracing the murder of George Floyd, the protest by Black Lives Matter and their allies, as this pivotal point that has taken us to this fight that we're having about America.
It is. It's a pivotal point in the sense that a wider portion of our country is paying attention. Of course, for many people, they've been for centuries making this argument that we need to tell the complete truth, that we need to acknowledge, accept, and learn from, as you said, what's happened in the past. I think I loved how Hassan explained that it is really, however, a set of voices that have now become at the forefront that are demanding we do better. And where I think we might need some help is figuring out how to do that, even amongst those who claim that they want to.
Well, picking up on that, Hassan, so this is a good conversation to have, correct? Not just the one we're having on the radio today, but just as a nation.
Not just a good conversation. I think it's an absolutely necessary conversation. And it's something that we need to have, but it has to be rooted in both honesty and respect. One of the things that we are encountering while having this conversation is that we're not actually dealing with history as it happened. We're debating whether or not to talk about history that occurred versus sort of a nostalgia about a history that never happened. And so if we're going to have this conversation, we have to be honest not only about the past, but we have to be honest with ourselves about why we need to have this conversation about the past, because the past informs and influences the present.
Well, Dolly, again, picking up on that, and there is something unique about America, something very paradoxical that we're founded on these ideals of liberty and equality. And, of course, the founders were enslavers. As human beings, how do we deal with paradox? Is that something that we are comfortable with?
Well, I have good news and I have bad news.
Okay.
No, we're not comfortable with it. It's that instinct we have to like straighten the picture on the wall. We want things to sort of line up and fit in our brains. That's an automatic reflex we have to look for consistency. That's the bad news. The good news is, however, that our brains are also robust and evolved, that we can override that impulse for consistency. It's what psychologists call adopting a paradox mindset. And scholars like Wendy Smith and others have shown us that when we simply, it's like as simple as just telling your brain, these two things can coexist. Thomas Jefferson can have authored an extraordinary document about liberty and freedom, and Thomas Jefferson enslaved other human beings at the same time. Both of those things are factual statements. And what the research says is when we tell our brain that a paradox can paradoxical truths can coexist, we actually become more resilient and creative as a result. It's like all that cognitive fuel that was going to solving an unsolvable problem gets deployed to actually doing what we need to do as opposed to trying to solve that problem.
So you're saying we say to ourselves, both these things can be true and I can live with that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Rather than trying to insist that one is true or one isn't, or I need to even if I'm going to acknowledge both are true, I'm only going to hold one up as the truth I offer others. I'm going to suppress the other one. Here, we can allow both to be true, and then we can figure out what to do about it as opposed to how do I force fit these truths.
Hassan, let me pick up on that. I saw a TED Talk that you gave when you visited James Madison House in Virginia. Of course, he, you know, essentially wrote our Constitution, but you also, and there's a beautiful view. He's looking out of his library, obviously, and writing this incredible document. What's in the cellar? And you went down there.
In the cellar is the paradox, is the evidence of the paradox. It's the bricks that were made by the children that he enslaved with their handprints, their little tiny handprints embedded in the bricks. And so when we think about, I mean, what has to coexist in our minds, our paradoxical mindset, as Dali pointed out, is the fact that the room in which James Madison conceived and conceptualized the Bill of Rights rests on a foundation of bricks that were made by the children that he enslaved for his personal pleasure and profit. Now, I will add to that, this is something that we, at least in the classroom, have refused to sort of reconcile. We tend to, all right, we're not going to deal with the bricks. We're going to deal with the Constitution. We're going to deal with the man who wrote it and not the people who enabled him to write it. But this is also something, Marty, that African-Americans have had to deal with, you know, from 1619 to the present. That duality, Du Bois talked about the two-ness and having to live with both being in America and yet not being of America fully.
You know, as you're, and I watched that TED Talk, and it was really worth seeing, Hassan. And I was thinking, I mean, in my own mind, I can intellectually do that. But I'm wondering, as a black man yourself, and for other African Americans, it's so much more personal because there were black children in that house who were building that house for James Madison. As a white woman, you know, that's a different experience for me.
Yeah, it is. It is deeply personal. You can't separate yourself from it. You feel it. You don't just touch those bricks. You don't just touch that legacy of slavery. You actually feel the bricks. You feel the children. You feel the pain. You feel the suffering. But you also feel the resilience. And it is knowing that despite all of the weight that they had to carry on their shoulders, both adults and children, they survived, they endured. And so maybe I'll leave it to Dali to explain how we're able to reconcile with that and move forward. But the two absolutely do exist in your mind. This is why, if I could just add real quick, is why Michelle Obama, you know, on the campaign trail very early on, 2008, you know, she has that moment where she says, this is the first time I'm really proud, you know, to be an American, to be America. Black folk understood exactly what she meant, right? But you had your white political conservatives like, oh my God, this is shocking. This means you're not patriotic. No, it means that we've really been disappointed in you, white America. And for once, you're showing us that maybe, just maybe, you get it.
Well, Dolly, this really points to the fact that history is so personal for all of us, right? Mm.
That's right. Absolutely. And it's, you know, nostalgia came up earlier. Nostalgia is like a sentimental form of history. I think Clint Smith has a quote in his recent book that's something like, history is what happened, but nostalgia is what you wish happened, or something to that effect. And that, again, it's a psychological need we have. We do crave that version of history, and it particularly when it ties to social identity. So, you know, like, I'm an American, I'm a mom, I'm an Indian American. Like, these are all identities I hold dear to myself. And anything that's about the past tied to my identities is going to be a little bit extra kind of prone to that nostalgic lens. The problem, of course, with nostalgia, I mean, it's wonderful and it sells. It's a multi-billion dollar industry across music, fashion, travel. Nostalgia certainly sells. It fills a psychological need, but it also leaves the seller that Hassan just described unacknowledged and unaddressed.
In fact, Hassan, you say we love history. We hate history. We love nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think the nostalgia that we love are the stories about the past that make us feel comfortable in the present. That's because we don't want to deal with, and I think Dolly laid it out beautifully, the implications that kind of hard history, those difficult aspects of the past, have for who we are today, for our social identity today, because our social identity today is very much crafted by who we were collectively in the past, and at minimum, who we think we were in the past.
Mm. We're almost up on a break here, but let me just give you a quick chance, Hassan, to follow up on that. This notion about, as you have described, the kind of Disneyfication of history that makes us feel good about ourselves. And there is much to celebrate in the United States of America, but not to the detriment of the tough stuff.
And that's it, because what we want to do is tell a complete picture. We want to recognize and celebrate the moments of triumph, the periods of progress, but we actually diminish from those moments of triumph and periods of progress when we ignore the context that led to the need for change, the need to make things better. And so what we want is to tell a complete picture so that kids can understand the whole truth.
Well, let's take that very short break and we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Hassan Kwame Jeffries, who is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University, and Dolly Chug. She's a social psychologist professor of in the business school at NYU. Much more after this very short break, including how to unlearn the things we've learned. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
This is The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Dolly Chug and Hassan Kwame Jeffries. We've been talking about why we are struggling with our history, the importance of teaching, also the difficulty of learning hard history, the challenges of unlearning, how to develop a mental toolkit to reckon honestly with our past. And Dolly, if I can just pick up on this notion of sort of learning and unlearning. And we you even talk about something called belief grief, where when we have to give up on something that we've, you know, dedicated our lives to believing, that there is a kind of grieving process that we have to go through. Walk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, that's so real. And I wanted to name it because I don't want to diminish, but this is hard psychologically. I mean, it's the honest thing to do as Americans, but it doesn't make it easy. I opened my book with a story about I spent a whole year reading to my kids the Little House on the Prairie book series. We even traveled to Minnesota and South Dakota and like took them around to see all the sites and was deeply invested in this story and these values. And I was quite frankly like patting myself on the back so much with pride as a parent that I was doing this, that I was like pulling muscles. And I remember standing there like on a prairie, a literal prairie, with my kids in prairie dresses running around and suddenly having this moment of, oh my gosh, whose land was this? And realizing that I hadn't, for the whole year I'd been every night telling them these stories, I had not told them that this land belonged to someone else, that there were communities and civilizations and cultures and families that were destroyed when this little house was built on the prairie. And I didn't know what to do with those emotions. It felt like grief, and it felt like grief that, quite frankly, I wish I could say I dealt with it, but instead I just suppressed it and like didn't bring it up and didn't talk to my kids about it. And I really wished I had known how to do that. And so that's the naming belief grief and then sort of talking about what psychologists know we can do was somewhere where I thought I could help us. But to be totally clear, I'm not a historian.
No,
Hassan
I understand.
Is the expert and it's a real historian. But I think I can bring sort of some tools that help us with the psychological, emotional part of this.
And I think of the stages of grief. If somebody dies, for instance, is that similar to belief grief that we've lost something?
Yeah, because it's not just a belief. It is a belief that was the underpinning of who we are. It's, you know, it's the pride we feel in, you know, our family, our heritage, our country. That pride is part of the identity that we hold to be true about ourselves. And often seeing ourselves as a good person is a really central identity there. And this punctures it a bit.
Well, I wonder, Hassan, just your take on belief grief and how that applies as a historian and how that applies to our struggles to acknowledge some of the hard truths about our country.
Well, I tell you, I'm so glad that Dolly named it, because this is exactly what I have been seeing in my classroom for over 20 years. When my students, and for various reasons, you can be an African-American, you can be a white student, a person of color. If you've gone through this educational system, there are things that you have been taught, things that you have learned. And when you enter a classroom in which people are dealing with African-American history or the hard history in a very direct and honest way, what I find is that my students go through the stages of grief. Mm. You know, it's denial at first, and then they get angry that they had been denied this history, and then they start bargaining. Well, maybe Miss So-and-so didn't know this, or my mom didn't know this. And then, you know, I have an office full of tissue because they come in for office hours and now they're depressed. Like, what do we do with this? I don't know what to do. And why did they hold this? And then finally, that fifth stage is acceptance, right? They're like, okay, now we have it. I understand it. I'm okay. I can deal with it. But, you know, there's also, and I think this gets back to the present moment. Why are we having these conversations in such an intense way now? Because while that fifth stage of grief is acceptance, I've also seen a sixth stage, if you will, and that is action. The students aren't simply accepting this history. They now, once they accept, not accepting it and moving on, once they accept it, they want to do something about it. And that, to me, is really what has roiled the water, if you will.
Here's something that Allison wrote on our Facebook page. She said, I started listening to the podcast 1619 to see what all the fuss was about, but also to try and honor the huge stain of slavery and what it means and its impact now. She goes on to say, eye-opening, as you can imagine, and I feel so illiterate to this history. And Hassan, if I could go back to you, is part of our problem is that we don't know this history?
Part of it is we don't know it because we haven't been taught it. But it's not as though it's a grand secret. It's really purposeful historical amnesia. We've chosen collectively to ignore those aspects of the past that don't comport with how we want to view ourselves in the present. So, you know, racial violence, lynching, the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre just occurred. And people were like, I never heard of Tulsa. Well, the black people in Tulsa heard of Tulsa, and black folk around the country knew of Tulsa. So it's not so yes, it is in part that we didn't know. But I think the bigger question is, why don't we know? Why isn't it a part of the curriculum? Why do we have such yawning gaps in our knowledge about the past?
Why, Hassan?
I think it's politics, right? It serves what we know and what we're taught serves a political purpose. And I'm not just talking about party purpose. I mean, sometimes it breaks down to that. But it serves a purpose for how we understand how we got here. Who has been able to benefit from this, from the American journey, and who has suffered from it? Our history provides, and the narratives and the stories that we tell ourselves provide a justification for the actions of the past and the beneficiaries in the present. And so if we're able, for example, to say that slavery was terrible, but once it was over, it was just over, and you don't look at the legacies of the institution of slavery, including white supremacy, but also the denial of the ability of African Americans to accumulate and transfer wealth from generation to generation, then if you look at the tremendous difference in wealth today in the hands of white families and the hands of black families, and you don't understand that legacy and connection because you've been pretending that that history hasn't impacted the present, then you say, oh, I guess black folk don't know how to save. I guess they haven't been working hard enough. And so in that sense, it explains, although wrongly, the inequality that persists today. It's doing that work.
And Dolly, I think of people that, you know, myself included, if I'm afraid of something, I don't want to deal with it. Is that part of explaining why we meaning Americans, the United States of America, why we struggle to deal with our history? You wrote about Germany. I've been to Germany. You know, I've been to Auschwitz. I've seen what countries in Europe have done to be able to acknowledge their terrible past. And it feels like a different kind of conversation. But is fear sort of at the base of what's going on here?
There's no doubt it is a scary thing to do. I think what we lose track of, though, is that it's also a liberating thing to do, because as Hassan was explaining, you know, if you don't know what happened on pages 1 to 99 of a book and then you start reading at page 100, you're just forced to fill in the blanks. Like, who is that character? Wait, how does this all fit together? Wait, what just happened? What was that plot development? And you'll just fill in the blanks because the mind, again, it's sort of like that need to straighten the picture on the wall. The mind will want things to make sense, and rightly or wrongly will come up with explanations for things. Things actually make more sense if you've seen what happened before page 100. Hmm. You know, it'll all fit together. And so while it might be scary, I think it's also in many ways, and I'll just speak from my personal experience, I have found myself actually having a sense of understanding and control that I didn't have before, when I would consider myself to be not only not a historian, not a history buff, basically an ahistorical being in how I engage with the world. But nothing made sense. You look around, there's racial disparities in every meaningful life outcome in the United States, and it just doesn't make sense if you're ahistorical about it.
And that is Dolly Chugg. She is a social psychologist professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU, wrote a book that just came out very recently, A More Just Future. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is with us as well, associate professor of history at The Ohio State University, editor of Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. Hassan, I want to pick up on something, and I mentioned the fact that my husband and I did go to Auschwitz. This was about 10 years ago. You know, it an important kind of pilgrimage to sort of help understand the horror that humans can inflict on each other. But I was also thinking about, you know, people do maybe less and less go to plantations and have weddings and ceremonies and parties, you know, something that never would have ever taken place at a place like Auschwitz. And I struggle with this.
You and and many of us along with you. The first group of students I took to James Madison's estate. One of the students then went that summer to Auschwitz, and she was blown away. And when we had a conversation about the differences in the treatment, and when she came back, she was like, "Dr. Jeffries, I don't understand." And I said, she said the exact same thing that you did. Like, she couldn't imagine picnics in Auschwitz as though in horse races like we would have here. And I think it has everything to do with the fact that we refuse to recognize a plantation. I mean, even the term plantation as also being a slave labor camp. So we've romanticized, because we don't want to deal with the harsh reality of how brutal the institution of slavery was. We romanticized this whole thing about what the institution was. This is, you know, today we're talking a lot, Marty, about educational indoctrination. You know, we're living with the remnants of educational indoctrination, because that whole view of the plantation as terror, as the old South, is born of the Lost Cause mythology, so that we would not have to deal with the hardships that was the inhumanity that was the institution of slavery. We would be better off not talking about plantations, but more accurately describing them as what they were, slave labor camps.
Hmm. Let me play a clip from Finding Your Roots. This is a PBS series that's hosted by Henry Louis Gates. And in this episode, he is talking with actor Edward Norton, showing him the 1850 North Carolina census that lists seven people, a man, a woman, and five young girls, that his third-generation grandfather held in bondage. And Gates asked Norton how that makes him feel. Let's give it a listen.
The short answer is, these things are uncomfortable, like, and you should be uncomfortable with them. Like, everybody should be uncomfortable with it. It's whether it, you know, it's not a judgment on you and your own life, but it's a judgment on the history of this country.
Absolutely.
And it needs to be acknowledged first and foremost, and then it needs to be contended with.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you go away from census counts and you personalize the thing, you're talking about possibly a husband and wife with five girls, mm-hmm. and these girls are slaves, you know, right. Born into slavery. It's just like, you know.
And born into slavery and in slavery in perpetuity.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's, again, when you read slave age eight, you just want to die.
And I wonder, Dolly, whether personal stories like that have a bigger impact on us than, as both of them say, you know, reading census data.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, I think every study that's been done on things like influence, persuasion, says that you'll most likely, on average, be more successful reaching someone through their heart than through their head. Okay. And often that means taking things and individualizing them or personalizing them. And that's what one of the things, you know, Finding Your Roots does so well, is it takes big macro events and trends and brings it down to the level of an individual. And you know, the brilliance of this show is they bring these celebrities who we, you know, we love their movies, sure. We love their music, whatever we love about them. And suddenly they go from being just a dot, a point in time, and they become this way for us to thread our way to connecting the dots back, like in this case you said, three generations, yeah. or so, in a way that's so abstract. I mean, my brain can't do that. And, you know, in my book, I call it the long time ago illusion. Like, we really, our brains actually have this asymmetric way of seeing the past and future. A year ago in the past seems like a longer time from now than a year in the future. The brain literally pushes the past really far away. And that makes it especially hard to connect those dots. I think the show does it brilliantly.
And Hassan, it raises a question about, you know, how responsible are we for the past? And if we're talking about American history, for our past as a country, if someone came from a family of enslavers, is that person today, are they responsible for what their ancestors did?
Yeah, so I don't think anyone today is responsible for anything that anybody did in the past. Certainly don't bear that responsibility for those actions in the past. And that's often the accusation that you hear today, that teachers are teaching little white kids, teaching little Kylie, right, that she's responsible for the institution of slavery. One, that ain't happening. And two, it's because it's not true. But we do have to, as Dolly pointed out, you know, so the way to get people to sort of change their or begin to think differently about how they understand the past and the present is to reach them through the heart, through these stories, the power of finding your roots. But at a certain point, we do have to move from the heart to the head. We do have to address the issues that were born of the fact that there are people who were holding others in bondage and benefited from that while denying others the opportunity to be successful in this world. And that created these privileges because that discriminatory treatment did not end in 1865, but continued in new forms up until the present. So our responsibility isn't because of our responsibility to addressing these issues isn't because we're responsible for what happened in the past, but it's because we haven't done the things to correct the legacy and the continued influence and impact of those things that were done in the past that are continuing to create harm and inequality today.
Dolly, should we feel guilty about that in this, the past, and especially for white people, white privileged people? And is that a terrible thing to feel guilty?
I actually don't think it is. That's one of the things I try to offer people with these psychological tools, is how to use that emotion when it comes up to not do what I did on the prairie, which was just be like, oh my God, I can't deal. To be like, oh, I see that emotion that's come up. You know, I feel some form of guilt. Turns out guilt is a really useful emotion. It moves us towards action, the kind of action that Hassan was referring to earlier that so many young people are demonstrating for us. So guilt, if it leaves us in a mire of inaction and confusion, not so useful. But guilt that helps us see the world more clearly, take action where we can, whether that's like big A action or little A action within our families, you know, taking responsibility for the narratives that we're perpetuating that are coming out of our families' histories, that I think is actually really useful. And you know, by the way, one of the things we know from research on emotion is that we systematically overestimate how bad things are going to feel and how long they're going to feel bad. This is called affective forecasting, that we're bad affective forecasters. So that feeling of guilt isn't going to stay with us that long.
Well, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation here on The Connection, in a nutshell, what history and psychology can teach us about the importance of being honest about who we are as a nation, who we are as individuals. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain, talking with our guest today on the fact that there has been a lot of fighting over how to teach history in America. Nothing new about that, but we are talking about why it's important to face some of the difficult and hard truths about the American story. Can we feel shame and sorrow and anger and still take pride in the things that makes this country great? Talking with Dolly Chugg, and she's a social psychologist, professor at the Stern School of Business at NYU, author of A More Just Future. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is associate professor of history at Ohio State University, editor of Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. I should add that he is the brother of House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, just to put that out there. Let's talk about patriotism. And Hassan, how do you define healthy, good patriotism?
And I'm glad you qualified it with healthy, good patriotism. Because so often when we think about what is patriotic, we think about it in terms of an uncritical, a blind loyalty to the state, state actors, and state action. I actually subscribe to a version of patriotism that I think is deeply rooted in the African-American tradition, which has allowed African-Americans during the era of slavery to fight for the Union Army, which has allowed African-Americans to take up arms for this nation in every war since and before. It's a version of patriotism that says it is not enough to follow blindly, but rather to offer critique, to offer analysis so that the nation can become better. This is what Dr. King offered. This is what Malcolm X offered, saying that it's not, the two can coexist. You can take pride in that which you and your people have contributed, and even what the nation has done when it's done right. But that doesn't mean that it can't do better. And the only way to do better is to be honest about the things that it's doing wrong.
And Dolly, you talk about a kind of gritty patriotism. In fact, you interviewed George Takei about his experience. He was interned along with his family when he was a young boy during the Second World War. How did he come to his form of patriotism?
Yeah, I was really interested in how he thought about his relationship with his country. And as I interviewed him, I was just overwhelmed by this man who for the last 80 years has kind of grieved his childhood, the loss of his family's home, his loss of their family's income, because they were put behind barbed wire and soldiers with guns. I mean, what were called internment camps were prisons. And yet, as he speaks emotionally of that time and the way it affected his family, he also speaks with such love and commitment to making his country better. And as I was listening to him, the word grit just came to my mind. You know, of course, Angela Duckworth, Philadelphia's own professor at the University of Pennsylvania, her work on grit, which is defined as passion and perseverance in pursuit of a meaningful long-term goal. That's what I kept hearing. I was like, I definitely hear his passion. He certainly has been perseverant. And this meaningful long-term goal he has is of this future he sees for this country he loves. And that's, as I kept thinking, God, he's gritty. The idea of being a gritty patriot, which I think is exactly what Hassan was describing, the offering of critique and analysis. And it's just bringing in a little bit of the emotional component that it takes to do that, the grit that it takes to do it, to be a healthy, good patriot. It's not what you wear. It's not which holidays you celebrate, though those are all fine and good. It's about kind of how you do this. Is it an easy love of country or one that you're willing to work for?
And I wonder, Hassan, for people that see the Confederate flag, for statues of soldiers and generals during our American Civil War, see that as a sign of their own form of patriotism, what do you say to them?
Well, I'm going to have to defer to Dolly on the psychology of supporting those who were insurrectionists.
But it's out there. No,
I mean, I think we have to have an honest, this is where having some actual history would be helpful, and understanding what it is that those who seceded from the United States or attempted to were fighting for. I think sometimes, it's the importance of the appeals to the heart, but sometimes you just have to lay out some facts and let folk deal with and wrestle with them, you know, on their own terms. With students coming into my classrooms and talking about that very thing, I can't before them, white kids coming from rural Ohio or suburbs of Ohio, I can't walk in on the first day and say, hey, this is what the Confederacy was fighting for. I have to let them read the words of Confederates themselves so they can absorb them in their own terms, in their own words. Then we can have a conversation about it. And so I think sometimes it is important to sort of lay all the cards on the table and have a discussion once you can kind of have some common agreement about the facts.
Well, I wonder, too, maybe you can put on your psychologist hat for us, Dolly, is that when you lose a war, as the South did, then you create a kind of nostalgia we've been talking about, or a mythology about how perhaps you didn't lose after all.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we are not wired to see the other side. We're not wired to give up power. We're not wired to, confess our own mistakes. I mean, these are all things that we are wired not to do. But that's why we have systems that are supposed to be wired to go against that human impulse. And I couldn't agree more with Hassan that I didn't mean to suggest that we can only do this by reaching hearts and minds, hearts instead of minds. In fact, what I have argued is that the research on social movements that shows that when you have both heat and light, you know, heat is where you disrupt, light is when you're sort of more incremental and meet people where they are. And those scholars have shown that when we have both heat and light, we make more progress than when we have, you know, mostly heat or mostly light. And my hypothesis is that heat changes systems and light changes minds. Huh. And that's why we need both in play at the same time.
Do you think we're at that point, Hassan, of heat and light?
I think we always have people who are... We look back at history. We've always had people who have been willing to generate some heat. Mm. And that is not going to go away anytime soon. I mean, that's certainly part of the African-American experience, the African-American freedom struggle, creating heat. Now, whether or not you can bring some light, I think, is dependent upon space that is created and opportunities that are created. And sometimes there's only a sliver. Sometimes there's a little bit more space. I don't think that space in which the light can exist is constant in its size. I think it sometimes the aperture, if you will, opens and sometimes it closes. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a moment where it's shrinking, where it's closing after having been thrust open wider than we have seen after the summer of 2020.
Well, because, and let me just pick up on that, Hassan, which is the sort of ebb and flow, I guess, of history where things open and then they close and then they open and then they close.
I like that better than thinking about history as being cyclical, because in many ways, these are extensions building upon continuities and disruptions. And so within that, there is absolutely an ebb and flow, because you have people who are trying to change the status quo and people who are trying to maintain the status quo. And that is an inherent tension that is always around.
Do you think we're a better country today than we were, let's say, 100 years ago or 50 years ago, Hassan?
My brother is the leader of the Democratic Party in Congress. Of course, we are in a much better place than we were 150 years ago. I mean, that is undeniable, to be sure. But I think the question is, could we have been further along than we are if we had done things differently? Yes. Had the resistance not been so intense? Yes. And can we and should we be further going forward? I think the answer to that is yes as well.
I wanted to, and I'm toggling back and forth between kind of history and psychology, but to you, Dolly, about whether is it helpful to think of America as a family? I mean, we're all here together, you know, whether we like it or not. And that, you know, in family systems, when you don't deal with the truth, when there is abuse, when there is neglect, you know, when there are terrible things, families fall apart they do terrible things, or people are really hurt and made dysfunctional because of things like that. Is that helpful in terms of thinking of America as a family? Maybe dysfunctional or not?
That's interesting. Yeah. I guess it is, as long as I think the problem is we've had the Instagrammed version of family is how we've thought about it. So the Instagrammed version, the kind of with the filters and everything, is one in which where there are problems, we don't show them. We don't address them. And what you're describing, the more honest version, you know, the Dr. Phil version, right, is one in which we are willing to address where there's problems, and we don't have a sense of entitlement that we can just assume this family will survive. Not every family makes it forward to the next generation as a functional family, or as a family where everyone's still speaking to each other. And I think we have to realize that we have to work for that and not assume it's just going to happen without some work.
Hassan, what do you think about that?
I think not all family members need to be invited to dinner. I think we have to.
Oh, well, you got to explain that to us, Hassan.
I'm just saying, I mean, sometimes, yeah. You know, you have some folk who are just so intransigent that they're more destructive around the dinner table than they are, you know, had they been left outside. Yeah. I think that's because, and I was reminded earlier today by a dear friend about something James Baldwin said. He said that we can disagree and still love each other unless your disagreement is rooted in my oppression and denial of my humanity and right to exist. Mm. And so if a family member is denying your very right to exist, your humanity, then I think that family member has forfeited their right to sit at that welcome table.
This is a little bit of a segue here, but to you, Dolly, again, you have written in your book about that we all have multiple identities, and we have this social identity that connects us to, the show is called The Connection, that connects us to each other. But that can also create, you know, tribalism and problems. Mm. Take that apart for us and maybe put it back together.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say our social identities connect us to sort of our close others, meaning the people who are more like us, and distance us from people who we aren't identifying with. They can very much pull us apart. What we know is that the way to break through that is to create like a overarching identity, a superordinate identity is the jargon, and superordinate identities, and that could be an identity as an American, does pull us closer and reduce that tribalism. We have to be operating, though, off the same script. And I think that that's where the sort of suppression of factual, accurate historical information is not only, you know, kind of cutting the script in half, it's diminishing the trust, because it's saying to the people who have a different identity, your stories don't matter. The reality we live in today, which is a direct result of those stories, doesn't matter.
I probably buried the lead here, Hassan, but how do you define critical race theory, and why should it be taught, and how should it be taught?
Well, critical race theory, despite all the hype, despite the political hysteria that has been generated around it, is really quite simple. It simply is a framework that says, in order to understand the past and make sense of the present, you have to take seriously the role of race and racism in the past and in the present. That's it. It ain't that complicated. Just take seriously the role of race and racism. It has nothing to do with, you know, these people are better than other people and inherent racism and white supremacy. No. It's just, how has race and racism shaped America in the past? And in what ways does it continue to inform our systems and structures in addition to individual behavior in the present?
Are we a racist country?
We are a country that was born in racism, steeped in racism, that attached itself to the ideology of white supremacy to justify an economic system that was based upon the exploitation of workers of African descent. Individually, and we still live with the legacy and a belief, deeply tied belief in white supremacy. Individually, no one is born with racial prejudice. Not a single person in this world is ever born with racial prejudice. But we are born into a country that embraces the ideology of racism and white supremacy, both in implicit and explicit ways. And that informs how we walk through the world.
And Dolly, I'm looking at the clock here. We are also a land of immigrants. You and your family immigrated to the United States. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, proudly say we're a land of immigrants. But again, if you look at some of the history, the mistreatment of the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, what's happening to people of color now trying to come to America, how does, I guess, our notion of ourselves as this, you know, land of immigrants, how can we improve upon that?
Well, again, I think there's an opportunity here to remember that not everyone, you know, immigrated here. They were brought here forcefully. Right. There were people who were already here when the immigrants arrived. So even our mental model is just taking a little bit of the story, not all of the story. But the other thing is, you know, I learned recently that while I was writing this book, that even my family's arrival in this country, which I thought was like, oh, let's go get engineers from India. And, you know, that was my father, and warmly welcomed them, was actually the opposite. It was a direct result of civil rights legislation that led to changes in the immigration laws to make those less colorblind, I'm sorry, more colorblind in terms of like Europe versus Asia. But in fact, there was lots of debate and resistance against doing that. I didn't know that growing up. I had a different narrative.
That was social psychologist Dolly Choog and historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries. She's a professor at the Stern School of Business and wrote a book titled A More Just Future. He's an associate professor at Ohio State University, editor of Understanding and Teaching the Civil Rights Movement. We spoke last year. For more ways to connect with The Connection, check out our podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. And you can sign up for our newsletter at whyy.org/theconnection. Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler produced The Connection. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.